You know, there is a camp for us old people, actually. It usually has names like Golden Acres or... I did enjoy the camp video. Of course, it's always inspiring to see young people and those of us who've been around for a while, which, let's face it, is most of the people sitting in this room. You look at the young faces and you think, well, that's Ed's son or that's Claire's daughter. I mean, you just see the parents' faces in the young people growing up, and it's kind of enjoyable to be a family that way. I think the phrase that got me the most was, what did the young man say? That it's natural for people to love God here. And if we can give people a week like that, I think that's a wonderful thing. You know, you have your work environment or your outside of this hall environment. I work in a environment of very talented, very creative, very annoying people. They're not annoying. They're some of my good friends. That was absolutely the wrong word. During the week, and it is uplifting, and it is stimulating, and it is profitable, but they don't understand the same things that my friends here do, and it's a special place to be part of that. As a matter of fact, I just made the mistake. My pocket was buzzing. I don't know if I've ever, my pocket calls people sometimes, and I don't know if I've ever called you, but I made the mistake of going like this, because on Saturday I want to know who I've missed, and it was the director of the conservatory at Baldwin Wallace College, who never calls me on Saturday, so I know there's a crisis there somewhere. I put it on a voicemail. Yes, I had a dream this week that spring was here and that the snow was done and the call of the turtle was being heard in the land. That's from Song of Solomon. I've never understood that one either. I think it means the birds are singing. And I said to my wife, no, it's not going to snow today because I had a dream and spring is here. So when you open the door and there's 2 feet of snow out there, just don't say anything to me, okay? I've never claimed to be a prophet. If you'll turn to Matthew 17, there's a story that basically I only want to talk about one very short story today in the book of Matthew. I've always, just me personally, in the springtime, I like to read about Jesus' life on earth. It just seems like a good time for it in preparation for the Passover, but also between Passover and Pentecost. It's just something I like to do. It's not all sun and flowers and trees. You know, there's some very serious, very heartbreaking things too. But I just find it very uplifting to relive the life of Jesus on earth and learn from the things that he tried to tell us in the short time he was here speaking human words to us. And this is at a time of the year which really is about now. You realize what's going on. As a matter of fact, if we'll start before the story that I want to talk about today in Matthew 17 and verse 14. And this is right after he and Peter and James and John have been up on the high mountain and meeting with Moses and Elijah. However, whatever the technology was that worked that out. And that was a turning point in Jesus' earthly life, because after that meeting, he was really focused on coming down from the mountain and walking to his death. And he knew that, and he tried to tell the disciples that. As a matter of fact, if you look up in verse 9, we're going to start in verse 14, but in verse 9, they're coming down the mountain, and what's on his mind? He says, don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. And the disciples... They didn't say, wait, you're going to die? They said, well, why then do the teachers, they want to argue about other things too, and he explains that to them. But although it was springtime and coming up to the holy days, talk about pre-Passover trials. Jesus had to think about walking to his death at that point. And so, although many of the things that happened between then and his entry into Jerusalem were in the springtime and somewhat lighthearted, always behind it would have been the knowledge of what was going to come very soon. And we don't even have to guess at that. Jesus talks about it quite a bit. Verse 14, when they came to the crowd, a man approached Jesus and knelt before him. Lord, have mercy on my son, he said. He has seizures and is suffering greatly. He often falls into the fire or into the water. I brought him to your disciples, but they could not heal him. And I don't want to actually focus on the fact about the boy's problem or the healing here. What I want to talk about is what Jesus was facing at this point. There was a demon involved in this case. Verse 17, O unbelieving and perverse generation, Jesus replied, how long shall I stay with you? He probably thought thoughts like this from time to time, but he didn't express them out loud very often as far as we know. But here it just came to a head. He knew what was coming, and here his disciples couldn't do things that they'd been trained to do for 3 years. His best friends on earth, the people who, for whom it was natural to love God, the people with whom he lived in his own godly zone, and yet they couldn't do it. O unbelieving and perverse generation, Jesus replied, how long shall I stay with you? Well, he knew the answer to that. How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy here to me. Jesus rebuked the demon. It came out of the boy, and he was healed from that moment. That kind of thing, of course, is miraculous to us. To Jesus, it was existing technology, so to speak. I don't mean technology in a computer-y sense. I just mean that he knew how that worked. He knew the lines of authority and power in the universe, and he simply exorcised them and exorcised the demon, and it came out of the boy, and he was healed from that moment. Well, the disciples, of course, would have been feeling sheepish at this point because they were going to get a job evaluation. And the disciples came to Jesus in private and asked, why couldn't we drive it out? Don't you wonder who got to ask it? No, you don't. No. You do it. I did it last time. You do it. Why couldn't we drive it out? And he replied, and these were his friends. It wasn't easy for him to say this. He said, because you have so little faith. I tell you the truth. If you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you. I don't know a single person in the history of the Church of God since then who has literally moved a mountain, which means in some ways we all fall short. Of course, it doesn't mean that the mountain would just jump up in the air and would move to the next county and land on something else. There's other ways of moving mountains, but his point was that people didn't have the faith to do it, and great faith will accomplish great things. When they came together in Galilee, and that's where they still were, he said to them, look, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. He didn't want guesswork anymore. He wanted to be very clear about what he was telling them. They will kill him, and on the third day he will be raised to life. And it's interesting, he didn't say me. He's talking about the Son of Man as though the Son of Man were another person. And it was the way he dealt with it, apparently. And the disciples were filled with grief. Grief both at the fact that they couldn't live up to the things that they were supposed to be, and also because, at least temporarily, it seemed like they didn't always get it, but at least temporarily it became a part of them that what Jesus had been talking about was going to happen and that he was going to die. Well, then we get to the exact story that I want to talk about today, and it's entitled in my New International Version Bible, The Temple Tax. That's the little heading above it. And this is the only place in the four Gospels that we have this story, and it's interesting that this is the Gospel that was written by a tax collector who was called, and things like this were of interest to him. It's possible that this story just didn't get around very much for reasons that we'll talk about, but Matthew had heard it, or at least Peter let him know about it. Maybe he heard that Matthew was writing things down and he wanted to make sure that this story got told. But let's just read through it, starting in verse 24. After Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, which is still on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus had a house there in Capernaum. After Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and asked, doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax, or the 2 drachmas? And Peter said, yes, he does. Yes, he does, he replied. When Peter came into the house, Jesus was the first to speak. "What do you think, Simon?" he asked. "From whom do the kings of the earth collect duty and taxes? From their own sons or from others?" "From others," Peter answered. "Then the sons are exempt," Jesus said to him. "But so that we may not offend them, go to the lake and throw out your line. Take the first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4-drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and yours." What an odd little story. If you want a title for this today, I always feel sorry for people who have to put a title on when I talk because I tend to ramble. I want people to think that my rambling is planned, but of course that's the thing about rambling, isn't it? And so the title today is Why the Fish? You can put commas and question marks anywhere you want in that, but it's why the fish? Why this weird little story? Why didn't Jesus say, "We'll pay him," or "Here's money," you know? Why the fish? Well, let's look at this story, because there's really quite a bit to it. Let's go back to verse 24. After Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, and again, Jesus had a house there, the collectors of the 2-drachma tax came to Peter. Now, this was a pretty common thing, and this is actually a story that we do have some facts on, and we know what this temple tax was, and it's outlined in the 30th chapter of Exodus. Let's turn to Exodus 30 and verse 13, starting there. And you will see that this temple tax, although it sounds pretty straightforward, is odd in its own way. There's some unusual things about this. Exodus 30, and starting in verse 11, which is where the section starts. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'When you take a census of the Israelites to count them, each one must pay the Lord a ransom for his life at the time he is counted. Then no plague will come on them when you number them. Each one who crosses over to those already counted is to give a half shekel according to the sanctuary shekel, which weighs 20 gerahs. This half shekel is an offering to the Lord. All who cross over, those 20 years old or more, are to give an offering to the Lord." And it was men. "The rich are not to give more than a half shekel, and the poor are not to give less when you make the offering to the Lord to atone for your lives. Receive the atonement money from the Israelites and use it for the service of the tent of meeting," which wasn't constructed yet. "It will be a memorial for the Israelites before the Lord, making atonement for your lives." This sounds like mafia shakedowns. This sounds like, if you give me money, you'll be protected. You'll be okay. We put people in federal prison for that today. What on earth is going on here? Well, first of all, there was a census, and it was God's idea. You will remember later on, late in the life of King David, he took a census, and it was a bad idea. As a matter of fact, God punished the whole nation for him doing it, but this was God's doing, and they were to take a census of the Israelites, and they had just come out of Egypt, and they were still getting the organization part of things down. So it was important to God, for some reason, to take this census. Now, when you think about it, two books later in the Bible, we have a whole book that's entitled Numbers. And it starts off with the results of a census. So this is not a small thing. This is something that's very important in the story of the history of the children of Israel. The Lord said to Moses, "When you take a census of the Israelites to count them, each one must pay the Lord a ransom for his life at the time he is counted." Now, what's this ransom for the life? The Israelites had already gone through the Passover for the firstborn. They had already been brought out of Egypt, and they had danced on the Red Sea, and God had rescued them or ransomed them. That had already taken place. So what is this about? It's a ransom for life. "Then no plague will come on them when you number them." Now, we don't know. I mean, a plague came on Israel later when David numbered them. So we don't know if the plague is attached to the numbering, or if it just means, if you pay this in the numbering, I will keep you from plagues. And God had already promised to do that on Mount Sinai. Each one who crosses over is to give a half shekel, which was a silver weight, according to the sanctuary shekel. So there was a standard that they have, and it was an offering to God, and everyone had to do it. Everyone 20 years old or more had to do it. And, you know, these are people walking around in the desert. They're not stopping at an ATM anywhere. Where do they get the money? You will recall that they plundered Egypt and that they had things with them, that they did take gold and silver specifically. And it wasn't too long into the story, but it did say that there probably are poor people who won't have this. So what would you do if you didn't have the money at that point? And yet you have to do it. You're required to do it. Well, somehow you would have to make an arrangement with some of the rich people or something, but people had to come up with it. Receive the atonement money from the Israelites and use it for the service of tent of meeting. It will be a memorial for the Israelites before the Lord, making atonement for your lives. Now, literally, that was true. They would see this because if you recall the directions for the tabernacle, there was quite a bit of silver used in things for the tabernacle. And when people saw the silver, they would say, well, that's where that came from. Because, you know, they weren't going to buy things to make this tent of meeting at that point. They were going to use the raw materials that came to them in the form of silver. They couldn't take the silver and just go to the nearest tent and say, we'd like to buy some carpet or something like that. You know, they had to make everything that they did. And so the value of this silver to the tabernacle itself was that it was raw material. It literally was silver. And that's how coins used to be. You know, this coin was done by weight. It talks about the weight of the coin. And we didn't just say, this is worth a shekel. It weighed enough to be worth a shekel. That our money used to be that way too. And there's pros and cons to doing it the way that we do today, where it just represents value. But in those days, the weight of the coin was the value. And what is all this about atonement? Well, what it really means is that people, and bear in mind, these were not people who had given their lives to God in the way that we do now. They weren't baptized and had their sins washed away and things like that. Figuratively, they had, because these people had literally come through the Red Sea. But what they were doing, this was their dues. This was their dues to be part of the community of God, to be part of the tabernacle community. And they all had to do it. And it was per person. It wasn't per, as you have been given, so you shall give. It wasn't that. Every rich person had to give the same amount as every poor person. You either were in or you weren't. And this was the membership fee. But it lived on when the temple was built later on in the tribes of Israel. This tax, you know, taxes are easy to vote in. Do people ever repeal them? And no, this one wasn't repealed, but it actually made sense because this tax came to pay for a lot of the activities of the temple throughout history in the tribes of Israel. It's not, frankly, an easy part to understand, especially when it's attached to atonement. We do know that things are different today. The whole tone of this is difficult because even in the Old Testament, if you'll turn to Isaiah 55, God makes very clear that his salvation and his bounty and his good things are a gift and that you can't buy them. That's the message all through the rest of the Bible. And that's why this isn't really buying salvation. This is buying membership. These were what we would call fleshly people, people who hadn't come to repentance in their own hearts and given themselves to God. These were people who had to pay the fee. And you know what it's like. If you are in a homeowners association, which I am, and you say, the dues are due on March 31st. Well, some people pay them on March 31st, and some people mean to pay it on March 31st. Or when students have to turn in their keys, say, at Baldwin Wallace, where I work. Well, we have found that students intend to turn in their keys, except for the scumbags who don't ever intend to turn in their keys. But most of them really do. They just forget. They don't get around to it, or it just isn't convenient. Now, what we do is we say, well, if you don't turn in your keys, you don't actually get your diploma or graduate. And suddenly the keys come in. It works pretty well. It's not a problem. Well, God is saying here, if you don't pay the dues, you're not a member. And you don't enjoy the privileges of that. And it was a pretty physical situation there. But let's look at Isaiah 55, starting in verse 1. Come, who all you who are thirsty, come to the waters. You who have no money, come. buy and eat. What? You who have no money, in Exodus where we read it, you who have no money still had to buy. You had to come up with that half shekel, even if you had to go into slavery to do it. Somehow you had to do it. Come, buy milk, wine and milk without money and without cost. Why spend money on what is not bread and your labor on what does not satisfy? Listen to me and eat what is good, and your soul will delight in the richest of fare. Give ear and come to me, hear me, that your soul may live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you, my faithful love promised to David. In other words, you can't buy your way into God's family. The good things are free. That's the eternal message, and that's the way God always was. That temple tax was for a special point in time. We know in 1 Peter, lest there be any doubt about this when we talk about the story of the fish, in 1 Peter, this same Peter who's involved in the story makes it very clear in 1 Peter 1 and verse 18. 1 Peter 1 and verse 18, for you know that it was not with perishable things such as silver or gold that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your forefathers, but with the precious blood of Christ, a lamb without blemish or defect. In other words, it's free. Peter's clear that silver and gold don't buy you that kind of atonement. So that was for a special purpose, and it was instituted that way so that it would actually happen. It was an administrative way of making it happen. You pay, you get God's promises. Nowadays, it's different, and it was already different by the time this story took place in Matthew, and Jesus makes it clear that at least for him, it was really different. Again, back to Matthew 17, and the same story, verse 24. After Jesus and his disciples arrived in Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and asked, doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax? Now, that's a very well-worded, good salesmanship sentence, isn't it? I remember when I was in government class in 12th grade, I didn't hate government class. I just thought government class was really boring. And so I would tend to doze off. It was my 8 o'clock class anyway. And I would sit there, and the teacher would shake me and say, Mr. Graham, am I keeping you awake? And what do you answer to that? You say, no. Well, you were asleep. But you say, yes, then, you know, you're really disrespecting the teacher. Well, there is no answer. It's like if somebody comes up to you, the old joke is, and say, have you stopped beating your wife? If you say, no, that's the wrong answer. And if you say, yes, you're admitting, I mean, there's no right answer. Well, these people were wording it that way. Doesn't your teacher pay the temple tax? In other words, the temple tax was well established. And it's important to realize that the temple tax was not evil. It wasn't a bad thing. It was a way of getting things done. It wasn't something that the Romans came up with. You weren't paying the Roman government to do this. This was your family, your congregation. And they assessed every male, 20 years and older, this temple tax. Interestingly enough, it was exactly the same amount as it had been thousands of years before in the book of Exodus when it was set up. And now, of course, it paid for the actual running of the temple. And not all of it, of course, would have been used correctly, because people are people, and people, they'll take their own cut here or there. So I'm not saying that it was all used well, but it wasn't a bad tax. And nowhere in this story does it even imply that it's a bad tax. It was something that they had to do, and it had been set up in the scriptures, so they had pretty good backing for it. So what does Peter do? Well, Peter talked, of course, because that was Peter's default mode. When you did something and riled Peter, he would just start talking. Sometimes it made sense, sometimes it made no sense at all. I love, as a matter of fact, the part where it talks about, just in chapter 17 before, not in this verse, but when Peter starts talking, Moses and Elijah appear and they're glowing, and Peter just starts talking. And the Bible says he didn't know what he was saying. Well, that's a nice way of saying that Peter just talked. It didn't have to make sense. Sometimes it really did. And, of course, as he received God's Holy Spirit and became quite a figure in the church, Peter's talk meant quite a bit. But here he just said, yeah, he does. Yeah, he pays the tax. Well, was he thinking when he answered it? If he said no, he would rile people. And one very significant thing is the next sentence. When Peter came into the house, Jesus was the first to speak. Peter didn't come in the house and say, you won't believe what I just did. Peter came into the house and Jesus started telling Peter what Peter had done. So Jesus has already processed this whole thing. He had been told by angels or some form of communication what had gone on, and he already knew this. Although he doesn't say, "So you told them I was going to pay the temple tax." What he says is, when Peter came into the house, Jesus was the first to speak. "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect duty and taxes? From their own sons or from others?" Well, when it's posed to you that way, again, what do you answer? Well, you would answer from others, because that's the way it was done. This doesn't really make sense to us today, because the king's sons are supposed to pay taxes today. You know, even some of the monarchies of the world are democratic, and what that means is we all pay, supposedly. Now, you know that everyone doesn't pay equally, and that's part of the problem. But in those days, it was pretty common for the king's own family and friends to be exempted. And Peter knew that, and so it was very easy for him to say, well, they get the duty and taxes from others. "Then the sons are exempt," Jesus said to him. And you have to consider this as a moment between Jesus and Peter. There's no sign that anyone else is there. Again, he must have told Matthew at some point, because Matthew wrote the tax stuff down and told the story. But what is going to happen then? "Then the sons are exempt. But so that we may not offend them." In other words, the deed has been done. "I don't actually have to pay the tax," he said. And he said, really, that Peter didn't either, because Peter was part of the gang at that point. "The sons are exempt," Jesus said to him. Now, at this point, he was always riling the Pharisees. If you turn back to chapter 15, just before this, and of course, this was all in the Galilee area. He hadn't gone down to Jerusalem yet, but these Pharisees actually came up from Jerusalem and wanted to investigate what he was doing. So in chapter 15, then some of the Pharisees and teachers of the law came to Jesus from Jerusalem and asked, "Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders?" Now, they don't say, "Do your disciples break the tradition of the elders?" Or we hear that. They say, "Why do they? We know they're doing it." So they'd already convicted Jesus and his gang before they asked the question. "They don't wash their hands before they eat." Isn't that terrible? "You all always wash your hands before you eat, don't you, children of God? You've never, ever eaten a thing without washing your hands, right? And before you go to the coffee table today, you will go to the restroom and you will wash your hands with soap and dry them off." No, this is petty, but it's the way they did it. Taya and I took a flight to Holland one time from New York to Amsterdam, and on our plane were many Orthodox Jews. And when the sun came up, they did their prayers, and then they went into the bathroom, and they washed. And they washed their hands. But because they were Orthodox Jews, they weren't allowed to touch towels that we had put, that other people had put there, particularly female stewardesses. So they just shook everything. And the bathrooms, the stewardess came and sat in front of us and just went, and she started speaking in Dutch, and Taya translated it for me. And the bathrooms were just a mess. And they could have done it a different way. But they were Pharisees too, and these are the Pharisees. If Jesus wasn't washing his hands before he eat, that means it's okay, right? But anyway, that was the big deal. Well, Jesus, being diplomatic and always saying the right thing, Jesus said, "Well, why do you break the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition?" And he goes into it. So he wasn't trying to win them over at that point. And he then, to make it worse, he said, "You honor God with your lips, but your hearts are very far from him." He quotes their own scriptures to him that way. And then he turns to the crowd and makes an example of these Pharisees. In verse 10, Jesus called to the crowd and say, and they've heard the question. He says, "Listen and understand, as these Pharisees from Jerusalem are standing there, what goes into a man's mouth does not make him unclean, but what goes out of his mouth, that is what makes him unclean." And there's a whole, you know, Bible study in itself. What does that verse mean? Well, the disciples came to him and said, "Do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this? You might get us in trouble." Well, at that point, Jesus cared, but he didn't care. That was the whole point. He was trying to put them in their place. Because by putting them in their place, he could teach other people the lesson and what was important. It was something that he had to leave with people. And the Pharisees gave him the opportunity to do that. But he also has on his mind that he's about to get killed at this point. So he's not really trying to stir up trouble. He's doing it when it's important, but he knows that he has to walk a fine line at this point. Because for one thing, he has to make it to Jerusalem alive so he can get killed. But he really does have to get there. And you could say, well, God will protect him, and God did protect him. But at the same time, he just didn't want to make life more difficult. And so he says, even though I've already told you that the sons are exempt, the reason we're going to do it a different way is we do not want to offend the tax collectors any more than we have offended people to this point. So we'll find a way around it. So what's the solution? Go to the lake and throw out your line. Take the first fish you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4-drachma coin. Take it and give it to them for my tax and yours. Now, before we even think about those verses, it's pretty clear that they were out of money. Because if he had the money, he would have just said, pay him. You know, pay him. We've got to do it. It's worth it at this point. Just pay them. But they didn't have the money. And, you know, it's pointed out that Jesus had a house and that he dressed very well. His clothes were gambled over by the people who killed him because they were fine clothes. And they were made very well. And you wonder how Jesus' ministry was financed, because, of course, he had worked as a carpenter in a construction business with his brothers and his family, and they had presumably made quite a bit of money. I mean, it was a large family, and they all made it to enough to adulthood to torment him at this point in his life. So we know that at some point in his life he had had money, but this was 3 years into his ministry. I've often thought that perhaps it was the gift from the Magi, and there's no proof of this, the gold that they gave Jesus and his family that might have financed that part of it, or at least helped him go ahead with his ministry. But at this point, there doesn't seem to be much money. And that actually makes sense when you think about it, because it was about now that the treasurer was starting to get antsy. The treasurer was starting to say things like, you know, we could have sold that lotion for a lot of money, and we could have used the money. Now, why would he be saying things like that if there was plenty of money going around? And he was also taking a side cut. The Bible's very clear about that. And so, you know, was he concerned because there was no money or because there was no money for him? Well, whatever. But the point is that Jesus didn't have the money to pay the tax at this point, and neither did Peter. He wasn't going to need money much longer, and after his death, money meant nothing to him. He owned the world at that point, and God would give him, always would give him anything that he needed. But at this point, he has decided to pay the tax. Well, how is he going to do it? Go to the lake and throw out your line. This is the fly fisherman's verse. I mean, this is the only verse in the Bible that we have where they're fishing with a line. The rest of the time, it seems to be nets. But Peter's probably going, wait, I'm being ordered to fish? This is what I'd like to do. It's, you know, it's like saying to Mark, well, go play the piano and there'll be a key between E flat and E. Well, Peter's being told to do what he defaults to do anyway. He likes to go fish and throw out a line, and they were right by the lake. Take the first fish that you catch, open its mouth, and you will find a 4-drachma coin. Now, this is a miracle. This is miraculous. There's no way that you and I could go fish and know that the first fish that we caught was going to contain exactly the amount of money that we needed to pay for 2 people for the temple tax. We can't do it. There's a word that gets used quite a bit by people these days, and the word is magical. And people say, oh, that's a magical experience. Oh, the stars, they're just magical. And I'm very uncomfortable using that word. Not that there's anything wrong with the word, and I like the sentiment, and I like those experiences. But magic implies that there's hocus pocus and skullduggery and supernatural. Well, there is supernatural involved here. And from our standpoint, we don't understand how this could be done because we can't do it. From Jesus' standpoint, and particularly from his Father's standpoint, as I use the phrase before, this was existing technology. They had a way to do this. We don't know exactly what it was, but they could do it. So from God's point of view, it wasn't hard to do at all. As a matter of fact, it might have been laughably easy. God might even have gotten the joke and said, good one, Jesus, you know. But we look at it and we say, what is this all about? Interestingly enough, one of the fish that predominates in the Sea of Galilee, and this isn't out of a Bible commentary, this is just real fishology, is tilapia. Now, you know tilapia. You go to Applebee's and you get your Weight Watchers special. Well, some of you do. Some of you don't need to. But, you know, and it's the tilapia. Tilapia is farmed all over the world now. But one of the places that tilapia originally came from was the Sea of Galilee, to the point where, you know what the trade name for tilapia is? It's called St. Peter's fish. And that's not obscure. That's just another name for tilapia. And one of the things that tilapia do, and if people farm tilapia, which they do, you know, you're supposed to avoid the farm-bred tilapia, which is hard to do because it's not always the cleanest of conditions. You know, thousands of fish in a small amount of water. You know how yucky that could be if you've had one goldfish in a bowl. You know how yucky it can be. But one of the problems that people who grow tilapia face, and again, this isn't obscure religious knowledge, this is just life, is that they pick up the gravel and move it around. They're always pushing it around. If you put them in a tank, all the gravel ends up at one side. Go ahead and Google aquarium tilapia. Not right now, preferably, but if you want to, you can. You can back me up on it. And you will find that one of the problems with tilapia is they're always rooting through the gravel. And here we are in the Sea of Galilee, full of fish who are rooting through gravel. And those of you who are fishermen, I don't know what it's like. I haven't stood at a river and fished for a long time. And, you know, things have probably changed very much for the better. But when I was a kid, one of the things that we used to catch fish was shiner lures, which were basically round, silvery, shiny things. And they caught bass and they caught fish. And I don't know why they did, because they don't look like bugs. They don't look like shells particularly. I don't know what it is, but you know that. You could, I don't know if you still can. Perhaps some of you can enlighten me afterwards. But if you went into the lure section of a sporting goods store, there would be all these shiny lures. And they would drag through the water. I guess they simulated minnows was what it was. And the art of it was dragging it through the water the correct way to make people think, or people, to make fish, tilapia, think that it was something that they wanted to swallow. But the point is, it isn't far-fetched that the fish would swallow a coin, is it? Because many a fish has been caught on a round, shiny lure on purpose. So that's not the hard part, particularly fish which are known to just go around the bottom, pushing things around and dredging things up. That's what these fish do. That wasn't the problem. The problem was, how do we know which fish has the coin? And how do we make sure that it's the first fish that gets hooked? It doesn't say anything about a hook. I mean, he could have had maybe a loop in the line, and he could have... My mother, when the salmon were running, the coho salmon were running in the fall in Montana, I did fish in those days, and the way that you fished for them was you threw in a grapple hook, which had three prongs on it, and the fish weren't eating at that point. But they were running so thick that if you threw it in and just jerked it around a lot, you often came up with a fish and you could just pull it out of the water. I don't know if Ohio's that way because I haven't fished much in Ohio. But I told my mother about that. I said, yes, you just throw in the hook and it catches the fish. And there's a pause on the end of the phone and she said, is the hook on a fishing line? I said, yeah. Yeah, if it wasn't, that would change the game a lot. You're right. Boom, you know, just with your little grappling hook. Ooh, there's water up here. And electronics. Nice. Okay. But Peter had some kind of thing on the end of the line where he could catch the fish. Now, how did we know which fish had the coin? Well, one of the things that distinguishes living things, all living things, from all non-living things on our earth, and of course our earth is just a very small subset of all of reality. God lives in a much bigger world than we do, but we know the earth and the universe. And on our earth, there is a huge difference between living things and non-living things. We know that, But if you say, what's the difference between living things and non-living things, it's almost impossible to put into words. As a matter of fact, if you look up life, and if you look up a definition for life, they tell you what life does, but they can't, they will admit, they being the people who are writing the words, that they can't tell you what life is because we just don't know. It's indefinable what it is. The only things that we know biblically about it, you know the verse, I'm sure, in Ecclesiastes, I think it's Ecclesiastes 3, where it talks about spirits in animals. And this verse gets brought up a lot when people say, does my dog go to heaven? Well, we would say, your dog doesn't go to heaven and neither do you. But that would get us into different trouble at that point. So at any rate, in Ecclesiastes 3, and it says in verse 18, I also thought, this is Solomon, as for men, God tests them so that they may see that they are like the animals. Man's fate is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. And, of course, that breath is ruach, or spirit, as we know. It can mean breath, it can mean spirit, it can mean wind. So when animals have the breath of life in them, it's a little more than just in, out, in, out. It's something that God gives to living things and makes them alive. Because you can have an animal with fully developed lungs who's not breathing and dies. You know, they have a heart attack, but they can't breathe at that point anymore. And so it isn't the lungs that make the animal alive, it's the breathing. And how do you start the breathing? I mean, we regard one of the biggest miracles of life when a baby comes out of the womb and it starts breathing. You can't say, start breathing, baby. The baby just gasps. And it's thought that coming through the birth process puts a vacuum in there and the baby has to gasp in. But whatever it is, something starts at that point, that breath of life. And when God destroyed the earth in Genesis 6, he said he was going to destroy everything in Genesis 6. It's worth looking at. He said he was going to destroy everything. Genesis 6 and verse 17. I am going to bring floodwaters on earth to destroy all life under heavens. Every creature that has the breath of life in it, everything on earth will perish. Well, life is something that only God seems to be able to give. I have to phrase it that way because we just don't know. But we do know that God can make living things and man can't. So there's something godly connected with life. I think we have to admit that if we believe in God. There's people who will argue with you about that. But living things, the way I think about life, and I'm not sure about this, and we will have it explained to us in detail in Life 101 when we're all learning about this in the kingdom, is that life has a connection outside of our four-dimensional spirit world. There's something about life that connects to the world outside it. And God can take a life and God can give a life. And it's just an absolute phenomenon. We don't know much about life, but it seems that God can work with living things. God can direct two of all kinds of animals to come to a boat and get on it. He can do that kind of thing. God can take a donkey and make it turn around and talk. It seems that when God wants to work in the world, that it's easier for him to work through living things. And so, for instance, when an axe head falls in the water, remember this story from, I think it's 2 Kings, and Elisha prays that the axe will be lifted. Well, what God says is, take a stick, hold the stick, throw the stick to where the axe fell, and I'll lift it up. Now, what's that all about? Why can't just God go, stick up, you know, why can't, or axe head, float? Why can't he do that? Well, I always thought of that as he's getting coordinates. He and Elijah are connected by the Spirit. Elijah has stick. Elijah throws stick. You have to think, what happens if Elijah misses? What if Elijah throws like a girl or something like that? You know? So the stick lands near the axe head, and God has a coordinate, and he can raise it. You think about it. There's poison in the food. God says, take flour, put it in. I'll take the poison out. What's he doing? Why do you have to throw flour in food to make God be? Can't God just remove the poison? Well, of course he could. But it's easier for him that way. A person with spirit holds flour. Flour is now accounted for. Flour goes into the soup. flour is all around where the poison is. God can work in that area. It assumes the shape of the soup. God can remove the poison from that. You know, God's healing someone. Why did he have Elijah and Paul do the weird thing? I'm not going to do this, Mr. Blakey, but going up to a human being and putting hands on hands, feet on feet, belly button on belly button, nose on nose to heal him. Why did he have Elijah do that? Well, Elijah's a human being. Elijah can give him the coordinates of human being. You know where the nose is because you know where my nose is. It's just interesting to think about. That when God works miracles, like when he does plagues on Egypt, what does he use? Mostly living things. There was hail, but mostly he used living things to do that. So when God intervenes in life, in our lives, it's often through living things, whether it's people. And God can direct a fish or can direct an angel to say, make that fish shimmy up. See that funny looking man on the bank with a line down in the water? We already know which fish has the coin in it because we know everything. We have the book of life and it isn't too hard to figure out what's doing what. We know that. Well, Jesus, of course, doesn't have to know which fish has the coin in it. Jesus has a staff. And when I say staff, I mean people or beings working for him. He can call on God's staff. They can identify where the fish is. They can make fish swim up and get hooked. Now, Peter pulls the fish out. There's the coin. It's not impossible to find. You know, they catch sea creatures with all kinds of things in their gut. This is a 4-drachma coin. The things that makes this a miracle is we need a 4-drachma coin right at this moment, and this is enough to pay Jesus' tax and Big Mouth Peter's tax. So Peter gets to take the coin to the people and pay it. Now, I think one of the funniest things about this whole story is, what about the other 11 people? You know, where are they going to come up with the money? We only have one fish. We only have 2 coins. But I think the point might be is that, you know, have you heard the story about the deacon who goes out golfing on Sunday? And somebody says to him, well, if you do that, God will know. And the deacon says, yeah, but God doesn't talk. Well, that's the way it was with this. And, of course, that's, you know, that's a Sunday joke. I keep a Saturday Sabbath. Yes, I do. But is Peter going to tell people this story? See, I stood on the bank of the lake, and he told me to... You're never going to believe it. Well, no, tell me. Well, okay. So he told me to throw in the line, and the first fish that I caught would have a coin. So it did. And either people go, ew, at that point, and give the coin back, which they don't, or, right, sure, and they'll leave Peter alone at that point. And maybe that's why only Matthew knows about this. Because maybe this was between Jesus and Peter. And maybe Peter had to learn a big lesson at this point. That the son was free and that God's family respects the laws of the world but doesn't have to live by them. I mean, no, I don't mean that. Please take that, scratch that out, erase that. We do have to live by them. But in an eternal sense, it's not the laws of men that bind us. It's what God has in mind for us that binds us. And so, to avoid offense, Jesus does pay the tax. Has Peter pay the tax? Peter was the one who got him into this problem. Jesus would probably have just gone the rest of the month, which was all he had on life to live, without paying the tax. He would have been fine with that. He could have slept well at night. But because Peter had already raised the subject, Jesus decided to do it this way. And in all fairness, it wasn't Peter's fault. The men came to him. The men were baiting him. They were trying to find a crack in Jesus' armor, and Jesus solved the problem quite well. Well, a lot of what I have just talked about is my own thinking. And if you want to argue about it, that's fine. I'll be leaving very shortly after services are over. It's no problem at all. But the point is that there is so much more to this story than just the simple little thing. It's a dumb little thing. As a matter of fact, people consider this kind of a fairy tale in the Bible because there are many other stories like this where people had a magical pot or people, and it's difficult to date these stories. The Jewish tradition is full of stories like this where people find things magically because they're directed to. But this is the only one like it that we have in the Bible. And I just thought, it's kind of fun to look at and think about it because even a little story like this teaches us so much about the way that God operates in the world and how we should operate in the world. It wasn't the end of that time, of course. Jesus at this point had to keep living, and he had to keep moving towards Jerusalem. And if you turn to Matthew 20:17, some of Jesus' greatest teachings, by the way, we're skipping over between chapter 18 and chapter 20 where we're going. He talks about what to do if someone sins against you. He gives parables that we live by today. He teaches people about little children coming to him and don't hinder them, and that we all have to be that way. And the parable of the workers in the vineyard. But then he comes down to chapter 20 and verse 17. Now, as Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside and said to them, "We're going up to Jerusalem. This is it. The Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death," still third person, "and will turn him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. On the third day, he will be raised to life." What's the first thing that happens after that? Still in Galilee, two of them, brothers, their mother comes to him and says, "Can you promise me that my sons will be in charge in the kingdom?" It's not, "We need to support this man. He's going to do something that no other man has had to do or has been capable of doing. We need to support him." No, they don't quite get it. They still don't. So even for the rest of it, you know, Jesus is suffering under this kind of stress. Talk about pre-Passover trials. We have them, but they're nothing like Jesus' own. And of course, then in verse 20, or chapter 21, he enters into Jerusalem, and you know the story from there. I thought it was worth covering this period of time today to put it in your thoughts, the things that might have been going through Jesus' mind as he was on his way to his death. And of course, we will hear quite a bit about his death and his resurrection in the holy days that are soon coming.